kids. That's Segundo here, and I'd like to let you in on a little secret. I haven't driven in years. There was a point in my life in which I had a chauffeur. He drove me to various dens of iniquity, and we often had a few laughs, although he never seemed to laugh at any of my jokes. Anyway, one day when I asked him if he could teach me to drive the limo, he refused, pointing to something called BAC, an acronym I still don't understand to this very day, but that was apparently in my system. Are you aware of this, listeners? Years later, when I attempted to get a driving license myself, they told me that I couldn't drink while on the road. Preposterous, I say. If a passenger can drink, why then can't a driver? I'm not sure if this is what Catapult had in mind with this book, but it's a legal inconsistency that's certainly worth dwelling upon.
Okay, so I'm here with Katha Pollitt, who is most recently the author of Learning to Drive. Katha, how are you doing?
I am well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. It's a pleasure to meet some of the people I met in the 90s or some of the people I read in the 90s.
Am I that old?
No. It's funny because like all of these interesting feminist writers that I read in the 90s, they have books coming out all in this two-month period, so I've finally been able to talk to a lot of them. So it's a pleasure to have you on the show. But let's talk about this particular book. In your title essay, Learning to Drive, you offer several explanations as to why you have learned to drive. You point out that you're doing this because you have lost your man. You also point out that your therapist suggested that this would actually work because you would be a good role model for your daughter. But isn't learning to drive a little bit more pragmatic than this? And maybe it's not so metaphorical as that?
Absolutely. It was very practical. Yeah. The basic reason I never learned to drive was I'm a New Yorker. And I went to, you know, one of these girls' schools where you learn to speak French and how to make a Linz retort, and the boys are off taking, in their brother's school, are off taking driver's ed. Mm-hmm. If you miss learning to drive at a certain moment in your life, I think then it becomes very hard because you're afraid of killing someone or getting killed. You lose that adolescent sense of invulnerability. Mm-hmm. So I had successfully big feminist. I had successfully found men to drive me around for my entire life. Yeah. You know, I had a boyfriend, I had a husband, I had another boyfriend, and it was only when I fell in love with the man I am now married to, who can't drive, he's legally blind, that the rubber met the road, as it were, and I had to learn to do it.
Wow.
But in the story, driving is also a metaphor.
Sure.
And it was for taking responsibility, for learning to overcome your fears and that little chauvinized piece of yourself that, I don't know about other women, I certainly have. It was interesting that I got a lot. That story was published in The New Yorker, and later it was reprinted in the, you know, Best Essays of the Year. And I got a ton of mail. And I would say about 40% of the mail was people wanting to tell me their stories about how they learned to drive, or asking me for the name of my wonderful driving instructor, who is the hero of the story.
Should have gotten a commission for that.
Right. So he got a lot of business out of that. And only some people sort of saw that it was a story that's meant to work on several levels.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting sort of idea, this learning to drive, because one can approach it rather literally or metaphorically, and in fact, that seems to me very much the point of the piece. You said, oh, I'm not being a good feminist because I had men drive me everywhere, but it could also very well be, well, here is this option. It isn't ideological in any way. Or perhaps you were a little lazy. I have no idea.
Definitely lazy, definitely fearful. Well, what you're saying is exactly what I said to myself for many years,
yeah.
And if I had not had to do it, I wouldn't have done it. And you know, there are a lot of things that you think you can't do, and then you have to do them, mm-hmm. and then you do them.
Yeah.
And that's why it's good that life presents us with these challenges sometimes.
In this title essay, you write, "Observation is my weakness," and in the second essay, "Web Stalking," well, you openly confess to stalking many of the...
I don't mean to interrupt you.
Well, go for it. I'll jump in.
I'm just going to say, you know, I was wondering if I had called that story, instead of calling it Web Stalker, if I had called it Googling My Ex-Boyfriend, would people have been so horrified by it? I really don't understand this. Maybe you can explain this to me,
well,
Ed. This is something everybody does. And yet somehow it's, you know, I have been called in reviews, maybe she's insane. Why would she reveal such a terrible thing about herself? Maybe she needed the money. I mean, I can't believe it. I thought I was just sort of like, well, here we all are. And in fact, in the story, I have a young friend who introduces me to this word, which I had never heard before. And she was surprised I didn't have a whole file on my boyfriend, which she had on hers, you know, with a social security number and everything like this. I get the feeling there are a lot of people that are very suspicious of their mates,
yeah.
which I never was. All I did was I sat at my computer and I Googled. And for this, I am being pilloried as if I was a crazy person. Well, I just don't understand it.
I would think that people are possibly objecting to the fact of, they seem to pinpoint precisely like you guessing the password and wondering what it might be. And hacking someone's email, maybe it comes from doing casual Googling, which everybody sort of accepts, but even like, you know, your friend having the social security number, well, then we get into sort of invasion of privacy issues. So maybe that's probably the touchy thorn that has caused...
You know, I hope that that story and the other ones are written in a humorous way. Mm-hmm. I not only did not manage to get into my boyfriend's email system, it was really basically a joke. I would be the last person in the world to be able to figure out how to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm the person who didn't learn how to drive till she was in her 50s, and I can barely find my way from one end of, you know, my computer to the other. And that was a running joke in the story. Is how, you know, I had sort of have these ideas like, oh, maybe I should do this. I'm completely inept. So I don't know. I mean, I just think that people are, people have an idea. People have an idea in their head about what a feminist is supposed to be like. Mm-hmm. And a feminist is supposed to be very dour, very prudish, but also very stalwart and present this sort of very firm, all of a piece self to the world and to be that person. But listen, nobody's that person. Mm-hmm. Nobody is. It's just like, I don't know. William, Sean O'Casey was very shocked when he went over to visit William Butler Yeats and found Yeats reading a detective story.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, you have to get rid of the idea that people don't have all kinds of complexities and silly parts of themselves. And I think that, you know, some of the people that are, you know, profess to be so horrified, although I'm sure they do worse themselves, I think they just, I don't know, it's just like they want somebody to be fixed, to be some kind of a role model that they can then reject.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, well, let me read you something. I mean, while we're on this subject, although I do want to actually get back to the book, you have the Los Angeles Times going further than even Tony Bentley, writing, I believe it was Susan Salter Reynolds. She wrote, "What could turn so fierce an intellectual as Paul into a woman who wraps up a rant on the perils of motherhood with the phrase, 'Fortunately, I loved breastfeeding.'" So I have to ask, why do you feel that there is this particular disparity, that one has to compartmentalize one's interests, or have you just pissed too many people off over the years? Or
well, you know, I don't know if we want to get so deeply into reviews. I mean, Susan Salter Reynolds, who says she loved my previous books, she reviewed one of my previous books in a very unenthusiastic briefly. So I think it's sort of like there's a reviewer technique where you sort of say, oh, I love this person's writing, just not this book.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not so sure she was ever such a big fan. But, you know, I would say the people who will like this book are people with a sense of humor. Susan Salter Reynolds does not have a sense of humor. She's a real non-sense of, I don't want to, you know, go too far, a real non-sense of humor type of person. And if she doesn't find, what she calls a rant, I would prefer, which it is not, there is not one ranting or shrill, another word I get, you know, feminists get a lot, word in this book, in my opinion, that the story about my daughter is, I think, about being a young mother is not a rant. It's an exploration of the contradictions of doing something that you find so wonderful, having a baby, having a new baby, and finding all the ways in which you're really kind of shut out of life. But not, because that's the way life is organized. Life is not friendly to new mothers. Mm-hmm. I talk a lot in that story, for example, about the whole guilt trip that is laid on mothers. You know, it's just unbelievable. You read these magazines, and the whole point of these magazines is to make you think of parenting magazines. You can't solve your problems yourself. You need this magazine, you know? And so I have a whole thing about that. And anyway, you know, maybe it's not for everybody, but I don't really...
Well, let's talk about the fact that it's characterized as a rant. Just as in the interview that you conducted with Deborah Sullivan, which I read the other day, she compared, you know, basically this book to Girlish Confessions. So clearly there is something here going on where your book here, in which you are sort of sincerely declaring what your life is all about, in which you actually say it is a life story. That's the subtitle of this particular book. People are drawing and coming in with their own conclusions. Is this a problem with you or with feminists? I mean, I'm just trying to sort of maybe see if you had any thoughts on this underlying cause. And I'm going to continue to obviously talk about the book again. I actually had something about observation I wanted to talk to you, but go for it.
Well, I can't really speak to what other people take out of a book. I think that I think a lot of people are, it's not like they're reviewing the book. And Deborah Sullivan liked the book, and she thought Web Stalker, she said, hilarious. So, which is something that I guess Susan Salter Reynolds didn't get from it. But I think a lot of people are reviewing the book, or not a lot of people, because it's gotten some very good reviews.
Yeah.
John Freeman gave it a great review. Book, you know, book list was very good. Most of the reviews have been good. It's just those two reviews in more prominent places have been not so good. But I think that a lot of people, when a book comes along by a person who is known, and maybe a person who is known for a certain kind of writing, they look at the book sort of like, it's not like they're reviewing a book. It's like they're reviewing the person.
Yeah.
And they're trying to square the book with their idea of the person and what they want the feminism to be or something like that. And so I think maybe this book was a little bit of a surprise to some people, and they don't approach it in a literary way.
Because it's not explicitly political.
Because it's not explicitly political, but also because the book is assigned to people who are not literary in that sense of being able to look at the tone of a piece of writing and know when there is a layer of irony there, when there is, for example, indirect discourse.
Yeah.
I mean, just to skip ahead to the review in the New York Times Book Review, okay, so she makes a whole big thing about men are rats, you know, as though, oh, and news, you know, big news, men are rats. But the point of that quote, which is in context, it's a little joke, because what it is it's me and having an, you know, intense email conversation with another girlfriend of my former boyfriend. And this whole thing about, oh, women are so wonderful, they're so caring, they're so warm, they're just so connected to other people, and they just have so much to give, blah, blah, blah. Men, the only problem is men are rats. And the whole point is that this is the way women talk. Women talk about they're so morally superior, and the reason they don't have boyfriends is because men just don't measure up to them.
Yeah.
The reason, and it was making a joke out of that discourse, which the point of the story is to undermine. The point of the story is that that discourse is fake.
Yeah.
And that what women, that is not what women really have together, their warm wonderfulness. What they really have to have in common is being sort of caught in a position of kind of needy desperateness or needy masochism or something like that. And that's what the story is about.
Mm-hmm.
So when Toni Bentley just says, oh, men are rats, and takes it straight, it's like she doesn't read the story as a piece of writing.
Yeah.
She's looking for a little quote because she thinks, oh, yeah, feminists think men are rats.
It's,
it's
almost as if she was reading the book. I mean, I didn't care for her review either. It was that she was reading this review, not really seeing how all the sentences work together. Like, for example, I actually wanted to ask you about the phrase "come to think of it," which appears twice in Memoir of a Shy Pornographer.
Oh, yeah.
And this suggested to me either it was a double entendre of some sort, or you were actually referring to the fact that you, as an editor, are trying to look for those things that actually appear twice. So something like that. I mean, it seems to me that whether possibly subconscious or clearly designed, there are more things going on in this than just going ahead and taking three words out of the book and dwelling on there. But I mean, but but you've also you've had these wars before, for, you know, for some time in terms of people wanting to just attack your character as opposed to the words, and you've often responded in letters. So I mean, how is this any different from that? Is this a matter of just trying to stretch out and try something different, and yet, so for whatever reason, people respond with this kind of inflammatory sort of manner, or?
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question, but I do think, I guess I thought, you know, that this is a little, this is more creative, more personal, more intimate. I think it's the best writing I've ever done. Naturally, you know, you write your letter to the world, you want the world to open the envelope and say, oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
When that doesn't happen, and I'm sure I'm no different than any other writer, it's not, you know, it's not a happy day. But I do hope people will just, you know, give it a try. And I think that, you know, it's the feminism raises a red flag. You know, I think that it sort of puts you in a box, and there is a lot of backlash going on. I don't want to say that my book would have gotten wonderful reviews if, you know, it hadn't been for that. But I think it got this kind of unfavorable review from, you know, first of all, Toni Bentley is certainly not a feminist. She's more the opposite of a feminist.
She's certainly one for the posterior, right?
She certainly, yes, she is. I was just kind of surprised at that assignment, because I just didn't see where, you know, her writing and my writing really have too much to do with each other.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not just that. It's just the fact that I would have liked to have, I mean, and I'd like to actually, again, go back to the book eventually. We have some time to do that. But this notion of taking a sentence and then responding to it, as opposed to understanding where it fits thematically.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's pretty basic literary criticism, isn't it?
That's what I would think. But I guess I'm wondering,
the context makes a difference.
But I would also argue that a lot of the people who have picked your writings in The Nation apart, and there have been all these, you know, letter battles and the like, have done similar sorts of things, where they're actually not looking at what's inside the sentence. They're just taking it and looking at it from the external. Why do you think your writing provokes such reactions?
Maybe my readers need to get smarter. I don't know what to say. I think I write with a lot of, I put some personality into my writing. I think it's not just, I try to, you know, have some humor. I tell stories. I like to put sort of lots of ideas in one column. I think in my column it may well be because they're so short, and that especially in the editing, sometimes that little sentence or that little transitional word even that would cue to the your average reviewer, average reader, that, oh ho, now we're having a change of mood, that won't be there. And so some people won't really follow it. I think a lot of people, though, who read opinion writing, they're basically just looking for their own ideas said by another person. And if you say something a little bit different, they don't like that. Mm-hmm. I get letters from people saying, you know, well, but the one thing you left out was blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, yeah, I only said that like 10 columns before. I'm not going to say that every time, you know. I love to get letters about my column. I mean, it doesn't bother me at all if people disagree with it, because there I feel like, you know, this is the, you know, we're talking about ideas, we're talking about politics. But when you write something that's a little more literary, you do expect a different kind of reading, a reading that's sort of a little more perceptive.
Yeah. I mean, is it a matter of, I guess, because you focus many times throughout this book on trying to sort of take apart sentences and showing, in many ways, particularly in this memoir of a shy pornographer, you show many times that these really terrible sentences that are there. But also, that seems to be one of the most recurrent themes throughout all of these essays, sentences, and how people cannot read them. Is this really a plague that causes the tempest?
the plague that causes the tempest. I don't think weather works like that.
I don't think it does either, but it came to mind.
Yeah.
I threw a rather awkward sentence at you.
Well, there you go. So now you know.
Yeah.
Now you know. Well, for me, you know, writing is all about language. I mean, I'm a poet as well as a prose writer. And so I think that the way something is said is very much a part of what you're trying to say. That's a little less true in political writing, where you're more like laying out an argument. But here, in this book, I tried to really have it be a little more complicated. And I like, for example, the tone I really like, that I hope I achieved, you know, at least some of the time, is to put humor and sadness very close together. Mm-hmm. And to put to have a shift of tone, to have shifts of tone, to go from one thing to another without always preparing the ground. You know, some people are going to like it and some people aren't.
Yeah.
So,
well, let's talk actually about the book. I had started in my, this before we kind of got into this great segue about you writing in the title essay, "Observation is My Weakness." In fact, I'm wondering if it's not so much observation as it is the fact that you are very interested in information and in a lot of these essays, in web stalking. That I think is really what it boils down to. And in fact, it's these observational skills that have led you to the place you are right now. So the statement, "Observation is my weakness"? I don't know if it's as simple as that, because...
Well, because you can be a very good observer of the world around you and a very poor observer of your own life. Mm-hmm. I am sure I am not the only person who has had cause to realize this. And in the story I say, you know, observation is my weakness. I didn't realize that my mother was a secret alcoholic. I didn't realize that my boyfriend was, you know, this world-class philanderer. I mean, now it seems, you know, this, at least the second thing seems very funny. But so it was really about that. It was about, here is a person who thinks she's such a big observer, you know, and yet she has to realize that actually, maybe not. And in fact, in driving, that really is my weakness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are, in fact, other cars on the road.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Oh, no.
In the essay End Of, you dwell upon the idea of what Saul Bellow has called departure mode, where about how one's connection with the world causes some people to essentially give up or scale down. And because there aren't enough regular locative landmarks that they can actually latch on for their particular existence. But I'm also wondering if, well, life is also about being relatively progressive as well and accepting change. So what of this other aspect to life that doesn't kind of creep into this particular essay?
Well, in this essay, the idea for it came from a beautiful meadow near where I have a house in Connecticut, just beautiful, that steps out into the marsh and then into Long Island Sound, that was torn up to make a active adult community. Mm-hmm. And that just seems so sad to me. And it's just all over, you just see it, just all the beautiful bits of nature being built up. So I took off from that, and I was thinking of other things that I really like that, you know, we're seeing the end of. And I would say, you know, some people would even put books on that list.
Yeah.
Or reading on that list. And that piece does have an elegiac tone. And I don't think it would have worked if I had said, oh, but on the other hand, you know, I really like listening to the radio in my car that I now know how to drive.
Yeah.
Or I really love the internet.
Yeah.
I think that sometimes I feel we are really losing touch with a lot of very important things, nature being one. I mean, these are not exactly original ideas. I just wanted to put them all together, because I don't think you're really allowed to be as sad about the loss of some things as you might like to be. For example, I've lived in New York all my life. And I've written poems about this, too, is the way our city is we're supposed to think of it as creative destruction. You know, yeah, they tear things down, but they put something else up. But, you know, the thing they tear down is often a lot more wonderful than the thing they put up. Mm. And I think now just we're looking at a city that is changing in very fundamental ways. You know, where Manhattan is becoming kind of this playground for the rich, you know. And, you know, there's Duane Reade on every block. And when there isn't, you know, a North Fork Bank on every block. And you know, I just wonder, sometimes the change can be such that it really isn't for the better in any sense, unless you really need to buy shampoo all the time. And why shouldn't one be able to say that?
Well, I don't think that they should be able. I mean, I think they should say something like that. But then again, we're also dealing with a subjective opinion. As much as I absolutely am saddened by Coney Island essentially being torn up, and that this was the last summer for the real Coney Island, there are many people I know who think that that is a very fantastic thing. So again, the big question is how you wrestle your own sort of nostalgia with, I suppose, other people's subjective views on the subject, or I suppose, in a certain sense, I guess, mass favor in terms of what is good and what is not good.
Well, this is the great thing about writing. You know, you don't have to give everybody a vote. You are not the community board. You're you. I write what I think, and if somebody else feels differently, they can write their own story. Now, in the real world, the people who don't like Coney Island won.
Yeah.
They won.
I know.
And the people who do like Coney Island lost out, and I think they tend to lose out. They tend to lose out because I think the kind of a sort of a very mass and corporate development is really zooming ahead in a way that is, I think, is very sad.
Well, I'm going to come in here, though, with a sort of raging burst of optimism and say, yes, the Coney Island thing, I find that personally sad. I find many things about the world extremely sort of sad, but one must have some sort of optimism, I guess. I mean, in order to kind of carry on, one must at least, you know, believe in something, you know, believe in some sort of good to at least kind of carry on in the face of a lot of terror. So I guess I'm wondering why this was not so pronounced. I mean, you actually say in this particular piece, like, I'm going to come across as one of those back in my day kind of people. So why not go for, I guess, this more all-encompassing reality of what it is to be alive?
Well, I think that's in other stories. I think the story, okay. I think the piece, the book as a whole, does not convey the sense of a world-weary person who's just, you know, I just, you know, you young whippersnappers. I think the book is full of joy and happiness. Mm-hmm. As well as sadness, but this particular story is a reckoning with certain ways in which the world is changing that aren't so great. Mm-hmm. One of them is global warming. I mean, you're not going to say, you know, yeah, but then we won't have to wear our winter coats, you know? Think of all the little fur animals that will be saved because people won't be making mink coats out of them anymore. I mean, global warming, which, you know, is a real disaster. It's really going to be bad. And we have about 15 years. This is just what, you know, people say, what the experts say, to do something about it. And what I say in the piece is, it's just hard to imagine it happening. It's hard to imagine the whole world getting together on something so complicated, requiring so much restraint and organization in time. And, you know, I hope it happens.
Well, we can only hope. You write also about your mother and father in this book, and I have to at least talk to you about this before you go. You point out in Miss Razzmatazz that there are many secrets, the unknown nature of the financial arrangements between them, sliding the money under the table when paying for a meal at a restaurant, the secret bottles that your mother kept. She had a quiet alcoholic problem. But considering this essay in tandem with web stalking, was this book for you kind of a way of coming to terms with secrets, or going to what you were saying earlier about the fact that these are essays that reflect different facets of who you are? Is this kind of meant to be sort of an interconnected set of essays, or are there certain kinds of themes like this concentration on secrets, or am I just perceiving it that way?
Well, you're welcome to perceive it as more connected than maybe it is. No, the pieces in the book are, you know, proofreading pornography, And then there's a piece called After the Men Are Dead, which is about sort of like, you know, well, what, you know, you get older and the men die before the women do. And what about that? And that's a piece that's very loving about men.
Yeah.
That's probably why nobody refers to it when they want to talk about, you know, my feminist ranting. The pieces about my parents, I could never have written if they were alive, mm-hmm. of course. But I was really happy that, because I had conflicted feelings about telling their stories, which of course is my story, and telling it in my own way. Even something like saying that they belong to the Communist Party, you know, you're brought up, that's not public information. But I was really happy that their brothers and sisters who read it, mm-hmm. you know, on either side of the family, thought that I had, you know, done a good job.
I mean, was it a matter of, I guess, because you sort of suggest that this, that watching your daughter grow up is a way of to, maybe patterns is really the whole scope of this particular book, is really a matter of finding patterns. I mean, was this, were writing all these essays a way for you to kind of tackle some area of your life and look on upon it with a new perspective? Because we're talking about the loving part, the so-called hating part, the funny part, the tragic part.
Well, you know, I'm not a very analytical writer of my own writing. I get more caught up in the sentences, in the story, in, you know, how I'm going to structure the piece, all those things. That, to me, that's both, you know, really difficult, especially structuring. It's always been a challenge for me as a writer. But, you know, I'm so caught up in all that that I don't think, what am I learning about this? What am I saying, you know, to my daughter about this, integrating this? I don't think of it that way. If I had had more time, I might have written, you know, a few more pieces and added to it. Like, I'm sorry there isn't a piece about poetry in there.
Yeah.
But I tried to sort of put, like, things like reading, things like books, I put all through it. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, there's poetry in various places in it. But I don't really think of it as a collection, in fact, either of poetry or of prose, as having to have an overarching shape. I mean, there are probably some people who would disagree with that, but this is the way it works for me.
So for you, the concentration upon this was more of a kind of visceral writing combined with a really fastidious take upon how each particular sentence was structured.
Well, I wrote a lot of drafts, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wanted it to seem very natural and very not labored over. But I was thinking more just of the overarching, you know, were there sort of overarching themes in the book? I would have to say, you know, yours is a very good idea, and I'm going to borrow that. I'm going to say, this is my book about various kinds of secrets. Various, you know. I like that.
Send that to the marketing team.
Yeah, I'll send that to the marketing team.
There are two points in this book, actually, I wanted to remark upon, where you note a woman cast under the spell. There's the point in Sisterhood where you write, perhaps women cast a spell on themselves in order to cast a spell on men, a leftover from the days when you needed a man to survive. And there's also the experience you write about of Anise Nin, who you saw in college,
yeah.
in which she mentioned the idea of a woman being enigmatic, being somewhat incompatible with feminism. So this notion, though, of being spellbound or a woman casting a spell, I'm wondering what makes this specifically sort of gender-specific.
Well, as I say in when I'm discussing Anais Nin, who I did, you know, there she was, very, I think she was pretty old by then, white pancake makeup, like a kabuki mask, and she's wearing, you know, this is like in 1971 or 72, she's wearing one of those long Indian hippie dresses made out of a bedspread.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, don't lose your mystery. It's very important for women not to lose their mystery. And I'm thinking, people don't say that about men. They don't say, it's very important, man, don't lose your mystery. The sort of the mysteriousness of women that is a very odd concept if you think about it. Women are just people. Why should they be mysterious? And what does it even mean for them to be mysterious? It means they're not being honest. It means they're not really saying what they want. They're hiding behind that kabuki mask and Indian bedspread, you know, yeah. and making everybody think they're so ethereal. So she lost me when she said that, I must say. And she lost me again when I read her diaries, and they're so boring. Mm. Oh, my God. And then what was the other place, the other passage you mentioned?
You were talking about sisterhood. You were talking in that...
Right. Yeah. That, well, there, I would see that. That's a piece about romance. It's a piece about the way women have a whole romantic construct in their head that is that they sell themselves, and that the relationship that they're actually having may not have so much relation, you know, so much of a connection to that. And then I'm saying, you know, well, what if people dropped it? What if they just dropped this whole thing, the whole romance thing, the whole sort of, you know, making a man feel 10 feet tall, the whole wrapping yourself in the beautiful Indian bedspread. And I said, and everybody just lived in their own studio apartment, you know?
That would be a bit on the
it's sort of like
terrible compartment. It's like that scene from The Crowd, you know, that tracking shot of all the guys working at their desks.
That would be a little like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's what that was all. That, I mean, that interests me. Just the way. I mean, romanticism is such an important feature of contemporary life. Everybody is looking for the one, or feeling that they haven't found the one, or they lost the one, all this. And, you know, I certainly, you know, in the book, come across as somebody who has certainly her share of that.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
In this story, Sisterhood, I'm sort of looking at, well, you know, maybe this hasn't served us so well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I certainly agree with you in terms of, like, you know, calling sperm sisters. That to me is sperm sisters. Yeah, that was quite. I've never heard that phrase before. But this is in relation to women that have slept with the same men. But I have to say, though, that maybe this enigma, this mystery, this so-called spell, is largely a perceptive scenario. It may not necessarily have anything to do with gender or ideology, but it's all perceptive. And so I guess the danger in because we're talking about spell and enigma in relation to two totally different things, and it's one word that is applied to two completely different connotations. So given this, where does ideology or gender come in, or is this really just a way for you to just kind of express a facet of how you perceive a situation?
Well, it was a lot. You know, your questions are much too profound for me. I have to say, I would say, certainly, men are there are very romantic men. Men definitely do this too. But I think the in my story, I was talking about a number of women who were all caught up in the romance of one particular guy.
Yeah.
And how had this happened? And so I think, you know, people should just read the story and take what they can from it. There probably, a man could write a story about, you know, a whole group of men that found themselves all, you know, under the spell of a particular woman. And that would be a very interesting story, and I would like to read it.
Well, fair enough. I know you have to go, and I could talk with you all for a long time.
Well,
but
this is fun.
Katha, thank you so much very much for talking.
Thanks so much for having me.